You're listening to episode 61 of the Tennis Files podcast with special guest Ian Westerman.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at NewBalance.com.
Welcome to the Tennis Files Podcast, bringing you advice from the top minds in tennis to help you improve your game. And now, here's your host, Mehrban Iranshad.
Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Tennis Files Podcast, and it's so good to be back after a little bit of a hiatus after Tennis Summit 2018, as many of you know that I hosted last month with over 35 coaches. It was so much fun, but it definitely took a lot out of me. And so I took a little break and also got sick, which is never fun. But now I am back with a fantastic episode with Ian Westerman from Essential Tennis. He and his team do a wonderful job. They're definitely easily one of the best online tennis instructional resources out there. And Ian has been kind enough to be a guest on the tennis summit that I did last year, the Tennis Technique Summit, as well as Tennis Summit 2018 this year. And so, I'm going to talk to him about a lot of things that I think will help you, as well as other things that'll be very interesting to know about, you know, the life of a very passionate tennis coach. So I think you'll really enjoy it. And without further ado, here is my interview with Ian Westerman. Hey everyone, welcome to another episode of the Tennis Files Podcast. It's really great to be back, and today my guest is Ian Westerman from Essential Tennis. Ian is a good buddy of mine. He does fantastic work in the online world as well as in person, obviously. And so a bit of background on Ian. He is considered one of the pioneers of online tennis instruction. He is the founder of Essential Tennis, which I'm sure most of you have probably checked out before. He and his team have produced an incredible amount of free, high-quality, value-filled videos that have helped, you know, millions of people improve their tennis games. I think the last time I checked, Essential Tennis has over 125,000 subscribers, which is incredible. And Ian also produces a lot of great premium tennis courses over at EssentialTennis.com as well. It's pretty cool. I saw Ian in Forbes at one point featured as one of the most successful online tennis instruction entrepreneurs alongside my buddy Will Hamilton. And Ian also has one of the most popular tennis podcasts of all time, the Essential Tennis Podcast, which has been out, I think, since 2008, which I really have enjoyed and you should all definitely check out. Really importantly, Ian and his team share the same passion as all of you, which is to become better tennis players. And Ian has spent a considerable time, actually, amount of time in the DC area, which is where I'm from. And one factoid that you may have heard on the summit is that Ian is phenomenal at driving stick shift. So kudos to you, Ian. I don't know how to do that, so that's great.
I'll teach you. Come out to Milwaukee and I'll teach you how.
Sweet. I love to do that. I won't drive too fast. I don't know, wreck anything. But Ian, again, it's really a pleasure to have you on the show. And first question for you. I know your first name's only three letters, but do you have a cool nickname that anybody calls you? Perhaps I-Man, Big E, I-Dubs, anything like that?
I've been called a lot of things over the years. There was a college teammate of mine that called me Biggie, which is kind of embarrassing. He liked to reference the Biggie Smalls song in reference to my name. I think he's the only that never like stuck. It wasn't like a hard like nickname of mine. Nothing really comes to mind. When I was a little kid, I grew up in here's something most people don't know about me, is I grew up in a predominantly Hispanic neighborhood as a kid, and the kids in my neighborhood had a terrible time trying to pronounce my name, and somehow or another they came up with the nickname of Spud for me. Wow. And that was actually like my gamer tag when I was like and like a teenager, and kind of my main online nickname for a while. So if you want to go old school nickname for me, it would be Spud.
Awesome. I like it. And one more fun question for you. Rumor is that you have the Essential Tennis logo tattooed on your rear end. Can you definitively answer whether this is true, Ian? The people want to know.
I don't know. Maybe I should just kind of leave that as a mystery. And if you want to find out, you'll have to find out for yourself.
Wow. All right. that's a good way to leave it.
So there you go. That's a challenge for you and everybody else listening.
Yeah, it's a huge challenge. Good stuff. Good stuff, Ian. So. So obviously, you know, you're one of the most passionate guys out there, as far as tennis goes. And can you tell us how you got your start in this wonderful game that we call tennis?
Well, it's funny you would use that word. I was on iTunes. I was just kind of scrolling through your recent podcast episodes, Mirabon, and I was looking at the reviews recently left, and the most recent review on the Tennis Files podcast, the guy says that he enjoys your show so much because, and I quote, "you are selfless and passionate about tennis." And so I'm really happy to be on the show for that reason. It's definitely been it's definitely what's driven everything that I've done, both getting into tennis in the first place when I was a kid and transitioning towards that as a career, not really transitioning like that. That's all I ever wanted to do as a kid. I only applied to one college, and that was Ferris State University, who has the first professional tennis management program. There's several more now, but kind of the first and main one at the time when I attended 18 years ago, which makes me feel old. but anyway, that was the only path for me. Like I didn't have any interest in anything else. I started when I was around 11 or so, just at park, like local, like public park courts with friends. Did the whole, you know, brought my parents' wooden racket out of the garage thing and just kind of hit around. That's how I started. Did some like high school rec program stuff, and then it wasn't until I was into my teens that I took any real lessons at all. And I think it was mainly my coach growing up that really planted that seed of seeing what it could be like to love what you do every day. And I was really kind of just infatuated with that idea. And he's the one that told me about Ferris. And so again, like I had no interest in going to any other college. Luckily, Ferris is super easy to get into because I've always been a crappy student. And so I got in because I had no backup plan at all. And I started coaching full time when I graduated in 2004. But then over the years, I got frustrated with kind of the status quo of what a tennis lesson is and what an average tennis student is, frankly. And so that's really what drove me to start making content in 2008. I started planning in 2007, like late 2007, and started executing content in early 2008. And yeah, April marked 10 years of doing the podcast, which again seems crazy that's been that long. But yeah, my passion for the sport has always fueled and driven everything that I've done, even the years and the hundreds of reps that I put in before I ever figured out how to make any money from it online. If it wasn't for the love that I had of the game, then none of that ever would have happened. And I don't know why I have it or how I got fortunate enough to find it or kind of figure it out, grab onto it. But I'm really grateful to be where I am now and be able to do what I do every day.
It's incredible stuff, Ian. And so it's kind of interesting because you mentioned that you know you have such a passion for the game, but you can't quite pinpoint, you know, how. I mean, I know that your coach kind of helped you develop that passion, but can you point to specific things about the game? You know, like is it the feeling of hitting the ball or helping people, or are there any, you know, any of those types of things that you can kind of point to as to why you love the game so much?
Yeah, it's something, I don't know, probably 6 or 8 months ago, maybe a year ago, I really kind of started pondering a little more because I was watching some content on YouTube, and the creator I was watching kind of put kind of put the challenge out there to more accurately define why it is that you love what you love, but whatever it is that you're into, like why is that? Like, go as many layers beneath the surface as you can about that. And it kind of started me thinking about it. And that was definitely the first aha moment that I had in pondering it, was realizing how strong of an impact that coach had on me. I only ever took lessons from one person growing up, and he just, for me, epitomized 100% what it meant to be a coach and to be a mentor and to love what you do and to be really excellent at it and to kind of pursue it with all the energy and all the drive and everything that you can throw into it. Like, he was just the perfect example of that for me, and it really inspired me. And it was at a point in my life as an adolescent where I had, you know, challenges kind of with my family and emotionally and psychologically, and tennis for me was my escape. And this is a story, like, I hear versions of this story from our audience, and I'm sure you from your audience hear this as well, Mirabhan. Is I've got just countless versions of the same story in my own listeners, where a husband, you know, passed away, or there's a cancer diagnosis, or I've heard versions of those two things multiple times, and tennis just becomes the kind of life raft where everything else disappears, you know, during that hour or 2 hours on the court. And it's not so much the doing of the thing. It's like how it engrosses you and takes you away from life for that period of time. And it's satisfying and rewarding, and gives you a different purpose for that period of time. And that's definitely what it was for me as a teenager. And so I just had, I think, those early kind of influences from my coach and the escape that it was for me and the satisfaction that it gave me. And I'm a quiet person. Like, I'm super introverted. Generally, I don't like hanging out with people. Same. And so it really fit perfectly for me, like, in so many ways. And I'm like a really competitive, kind of intense personality, but very kind of inwardly, although tennis really kind of brings it out of me, which it does for a lot of people. But so anyway, yeah, it fit so many different kind of deep personal things, like, just right. And so I don't know. There's a bunch of different angles to it there, but off the top of my head, that's the best way I can explain it.
Yeah, no, it's a great explanation, Ian. Appreciate that. And yeah, you actually reminded me of, in talking about tennis being an escape, I recently read that Roberto Bautista Agut, his mom actually passed away, I think, a week ago, and he actually chose to play, French Open, and he said, you know, just to kind of take his mind off things. So, but yeah, it's just a wonderful, wonderful sport to play, and there's so many different facets of it to master, and it, you know, takes a lifetime. But I'm just curious to ask you too about your junior career, Ian, to kind of maybe connect with junior players and those who have played, you know, competitively in the juniors. So just ask, you know, how you would characterize your junior career, you know, and what types of obstacles you faced as a young player.
I would describe my junior career as underwhelming. I started relatively late. My family really didn't have the finances to really support me much. Or any of my, I've got three siblings. Like, none of us really, we weren't that family where everybody had their sport that they go out and do. Like, we didn't have the money for that. And so, I got help from grandparents. I worked a lot myself, did a lot of different, like, paper routes, and worked for a janitorial service for a while. And so I didn't have the normal, like, junior, like, high performance junior kind of story, or at least not your typical person who goes on to play college tennis and that sort of thing, where it's academies and lessons and that sort of thing. So one lesson a week was pretty much the best I could do. And even then, my coach frequently would just charge me for the court time. That's the kind of guy that my coach was. I mean, he would literally donate his time to me because he knew how important it was for me. And we just kind of connected on that level as far as it, I think, being important to both of us. But I was homeschooled, and I think that's something else most people don't know about me. And I didn't go to a normal school until I was a junior in high school. And so I only played 2 years of high school tennis at a small, like, private Lutheran school here in the Milwaukee area, and did pretty much dominated those 2 years, which was great. It was a lot of fun, just kind of being the guy everybody looked up to on the team, and kind of being a big fish in a really small pond as far as my school was concerned. And so that gave me a lot of good competitive experience, gave me good experience kind of being in that role of kind of the leader on the team. I played a couple of like USTA tournaments, but hardly anything. I would play maybe one or two a year or something, and like lose in the first or second round. And I think I had a Wisconsin State ranking, but I don't remember what it was. Like just making the book, I was like super pumped that my name was just in there someplace. So yeah, that was my junior career. And I didn't make my college team my first year. I walked on my second year. I worked super, super hard my freshman year, training kind of on my own and with other PTM students to improve my game. And then I started getting asked occasionally to practice with the team when somebody was sick or whatever. And I just kind of worked my way onto the team, and then played 3 years of NCAA Division II tennis, which is definitely, for me personally, at this point in my life, is definitely my competitive highlight were those years of being on that team and competing.
That's great stuff, Ian. And, you know, a lot of people can relate to, you know, not making a team at first and then, you know, needing to work really hard in order to make it. So, you know, what kind of improvements did you end up making that you think allowed you to make, you know, the Fair State University team?
Oh man, that's a good question. I mean, again, coming from a small private high school and kind of that level of competition, and I played against, when it came time for like regional tournament, that sort of thing, or the state tournament, like I played some of the better players in the state. So I had some exposure to high level junior players, at least in my, you know, in Wisconsin. It's not like Texas or California, or anything like that. But so I had some context for what the higher level of competition was, but it wasn't really until I visited Ferris. I'll definitely never forget visiting for the first time my junior year of high school and watching a team practice and just being absolutely, they were, the team was definitely top 20 NCAA Division II at that point in time. And I think had the number one or number two doubles team in Division II at that point in time. So going and watching that totally blew me away and gave me, you know, just the appreciation or perspective of several levels and layers of execution above where I was. And then when I actually got there and I had the chance to hit with a couple of those guys, I think the main difference was probably just energy, effort, acceleration, racket head speed. I mean, everything just had to get ratcheted up in intensity. I think that's probably the main thing. So it's a matter of getting used to the pace, getting used to the change in tempo, used to the heaviness of shot, and then being able to not only, you know, rebound that, but give them, you know, my own version of it and actually be able to go toe to toe with that level of shot. So it was probably just overall acceleration, athleticism, and racket head speed was probably the biggest thing that I don't remember like purposefully training that, but it just really became self-evident hitting with those guys. I just had to hit a much higher quality ball to be anywhere close to that level.
Yeah, it's great stuff again, Ian, and that does show why it's very helpful, obviously, to hit with higher level players because they can inspire you and also push you to, you know, play a lot more with a lot more intensity as well. So, and you know, obviously, you played several years of college tennis. You said so. Is there a particular highlight, you know, of your tennis career that you can of your college tennis career that you can remember?
Yeah, for sure. I don't know that I've talked about this either. Man, you're just bringing all kind of stories out of me, Mirabhan.
I try.
Let me think. It was my junior year, my second year on the team. We had a transfer that was supposed to come in, really strong player. He was going to be like the top two or top three person on the team. He was transferring in from the Pacific Northwest, and he was going to play with our number one doubles player. And there was some administrative or like paperwork problem with his transfer, and so he was ineligible for several weeks. And early in the season was our regional tournament, our individual NCAA tournament, and to keep from breaking up the rest of the lineup, number two, number three doubles, the coach put me in with the number one doubles player. I was the bottom of the line. I was playing number three, and I was playing number three doubles, and I was playing number six singles at the time. And so he put me in with I think he was number two singles and number one doubles player at the time. And he and I were good friends. We had already known each other for probably 3 years at that time. And so we went in unseeded, whereas him and his normal partner probably would have been the number one or the number two seed. It was us and another main team in our conference. And so we went in unseeded, and you know, I'm sure nobody expected us to do anything much, but we won the first round. And then really, for me, competitively, this is the highlight. Like, individual highlight was this tournament, where is the best example for myself of being partnered with somebody who just knew how to bring another level of execution and intensity and focus and competitiveness out of me. And it was because of his approach to being a doubles partner. It was because of his approach to the game of doubles. Tactically, he was smarter than me. Physically and athletically, he was bigger and stronger. And, you know, just he was at another level of me. He was at another level above me on every, you know, measurement possible: mental toughness, tactics, you know, strength, shot making, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, you hear about people playing down to their partner. You hear about people playing up to their partner. This was just my personal best possible example of playing up to a partner. And my entire game raised, and I learned, I have a lot of like individual lessons that I learned during that weekend of competing with him. And in total, I think we played five matches. We beat three seeded teams. None of which, you know, we should have probably had any business beating, but one or two of them we beat, like we pretty much rolled over. And I was just in the zone that entire weekend, and just like in a completely different like universe of execution and confidence. And it was just really amazing experience for me. And we ended up losing in the finals. Had we won the last match, we would have gone to nationals, and which is the final 16 teams for the individual NCAA tournament. And my serve got broken. I think it was at 4-4. It was an 8-game pro set. Maybe it was 5-5. There was one break in the set, and it was my serve. And I was definitely pretty crushed by that. It would have been nice to go to a tiebreaker, you know, have some other opportunities to try to win. But I so overperformed that entire weekend. And so I'm really grateful for that experience and everything I learned from it. The whole thing was kind of a surreal experience for me in the moment. And really happy I had the opportunity to experience that.
I mean, that's an incredible experience, and it's always fun to play with players who are at a you know, higher level than you. To, you know, you kind of adopt again the intensity, and also if your partner is a you know, great tactician and stuff, you know, they'll know how to bring the best out of you. And so this is a great lesson for people to, you know, if you are that better player too, you know, don't just stand around there and just play like a robot, but try to bring out the best in your partner, because it can make a huge difference.
100%.
So. Really awesome experience. Appreciate you sharing that with us. And Ian, you know, obviously you mentioned that you took the professional tennis management program, otherwise known as PTM, at Ferris State. I was just curious if you could tell us your experience with that program and some key takeaways, because obviously we have a lot of listeners who may be interested in, you know, pursuing a career in the tennis world. So this might be very helpful for them.
Yeah, I mean, for anybody listening who feels like tennis is calling them and they just need to be a part of the sport, then I couldn't recommend that program highly enough. I mean, it's just, I think the main thing, there's a lot of things that I took away from it. Obviously, the team experience was amazing, but the program itself, which is a four-year business marketing degree, a bachelor's degree, and then a minor in, I believe they called it professional tennis, and there were actual classes involved there, classes like racket maintenance and stringing and tournament administration and teaching techniques and technical analysis and that sort of thing. Like those were all actual accredited like courses through the PTM program. And so it's really tailor-made for somebody who knows that they want to spend their career in the tennis industry. It could be anything. It could be coaching. It could be working as a sales rep at a manufacturer or whatever. It could be clothing line, or pro shop, merchandising, anything related to tennis. I think it's just a really perfect setup. And I think with Ferris in particular, I believe the real strength there is just in the connections to the tennis industry. And the Ferris program specifically was founded by Scott Schultz, who is unbelievably connected. He was the president of the USTA, or was it vice president? The president or vice president of the USTA, just really, really high up in the tennis industry. And everything just kind of trickles down from there. And so there's just a huge amount of direct connection and relationships, which really is everything. And especially in a small industry like tennis, where everybody knows everybody, having just a handful of really strategic connections or relationships makes all the difference. And it was definitely the case for me. I ended up getting a job at a club a year out of college that I never, ever, I literally wouldn't have had a call back from, but I ended up getting the position just simply because Scott Schultz called and said, "Hey, so you have a position open and one of my graduates has a resume in your stack and really appreciate, he's a great guy, et cetera, et cetera." And so that's what got my foot in the door. And without that, foot in the door opportunity, there's no way I would have been considered for the position. So that kind of relationship or connection in the industry, I think, is really priceless. And so if, for somebody who's kind of on the fence and they're just not quite sure what they want to do with their life, like, I definitely wouldn't recommend just doing it just because it sounds cool. Where I would really strongly encourage people to look into it is if it's something where they really feel drawn towards tennis, kind of like me or like you, Mirban, and it's something where you kind of just have to go in that direction, then I think Ferris is an obvious choice.
Awesome. Obviously, a ringing endorsement. Definitely agree. I know several people who went to Ferris State, and I could be wrong, but I think David Ramos from USTA has gone there, and also Konstantin Khodarev, who is the head pro at Wintergreen right now still. But yeah, that's great stuff, Ian. And so, kind of going back to your experience coaching tennis players at tennis clubs, so I guess you got that first job with the help of, by knowing Scott, and then can you take us through, I'm just curious about your route through, I know you were at Congressional as well, but were there any other clubs that you coached at as well?
Yeah, Congressional was the club I was referring to. I got a job, the job I got right out of college was back in Wisconsin where I'm from, and it was really just kind of a starter job back around my family. Great club there, like really amazing facility, an amazing kind of family environment. So yeah, another kind of private club, didn't have golf, but swimming and dining, that sort of thing. So kind of a country club type atmosphere. And so I worked there for a year, year and a half. My wife and I really kind of wanted to get outside of the Midwest. And that's why we looked at the DC area. We actually both had summer internships out there when we were in college. What was your question?
Oh, sorry. Yeah, just going through kind of your coaching jobs at various country clubs or, you know, tennis clubs.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, so Congressional was the second job that I had out of college. And it was, I mean, one of the best private clubs in the country, much less the D.C. area. We love the D.C. area. So I applied there immediately and had, when I got offered the job, just absolutely had to move out there. And so it was a great opportunity and loved my time there. And people treated both of us extremely well. But what I found, what I learned, and this was a lesson I started learning at my first job back here in Wisconsin. In fact, I remember a closed door meeting I had with the director of tennis, my boss at my first job, where I literally called a meeting with him because I think this was a couple weeks or a couple months into my first full-time teaching job, because I was just so I was so frustrated at the percentage of people who book time with me, whether it was for themselves or for their kids or whatever. But there was just a big percentage of time in my schedule that was devoted to people that were not on the court for the same reason that I was. I was on the court because I just absolutely loved and thrived on giving people advice and instruction and helping them come to aha moments, like seeing the light bulb go off in their head and then seeing them run with what I taught them and see them be more successful and have more fun, get more enjoyment out of the game. Like, I wanted to help people develop as tennis players. And there was a huge percentage of time on the court that was being spent just being a facilitator of an activity. Like, people were there for reasons other than passion for the game and improvement. They were there for recreation. They were there for exercise. They were there to socialize. They were there for babysitting for their kids. Like, there were, and no judgment. Like, that's fine. Like, for those people, that's totally fine. Like, if they're honest and they know what they want to get out of it and that's what they're getting out of it, then awesome. And I'm happy for all of those people to get out of it what they want to get out of it. But it wasn't a match for why I was there. And so, frankly, at first, I was probably pretty naive going into a private club setting and expecting that people were going to match my level of enthusiasm for working hard and focusing and learning and improving. But it was what it was. And so it kind of blindsided me a little bit. And I continued into my second job at Congressional. And ultimately, it's what fueled my publishing online. Was I saw other people in other topics, other niches, publishing content, growing an audience. Podcasts were really my first big content love online. I listened to a personal finance guy. I listened to some internet business guys. And I was like, all right, so these people, they know something about a topic. They're publishing content. They're growing an audience. They're selling services and products to help that audience reach their goals. They're making a living out of it. And so it just, after a while, became just an obvious thing for me to try. And I thought, why can't I do that also? And so it was an opportunity for me to put myself out there and attract the people who met me at my level, you know, and I met them at their level. And so it's like a mutual respect and a mutual gratitude for each other. Like, that's ultimately what I was after. And I found it through Essential Tennis, which I'm super grateful for.
Introducing Coco Gauff's signature shoe, more than just a tennis shoe. It's a fusion of 90s-inspired style and cutting-edge performance technology. With its sleek mid-cut silhouette, it's designed to enhance speed and power on the court. The multi-piece upper construction delivers high-energy return for players of all levels. Whether you're a seasoned pro or just starting out, the Coco CG1 empowers you to dominate the game. Learn more and purchase the Coco CG1 at newbalance.com.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Yeah, you know, Ian, in a way, it's great that you didn't get what you were looking for in your job, because otherwise we may not have Essential Tennis, because obviously it's really tough when you're giving your all and hoping that people improve, but they don't really care about that in certain settings. And so I was going to kind of ask, like, if at any point did you think about maybe going to like a high performance program or something like that, where the students like are looking to improve or something?
Yeah, in hindsight, like, that's why I kind of said I was probably being a little naive,
right?
Going into my first job at a private club, just in my 21-year-old brain, I was probably just looking at the biggest, you know, most impressive, most expensive clubs as being the place where I could build the best career, and I wasn't self-aware enough yet at the time to understand, A, how kind of different I was from that culture, and B, like how much that really meant to me and how unhappy it was going to make me if I had to. And don't get me wrong, like, again, like, people at Congressional treated me amazing, treated my family amazing. As far as private clubs are concerned, like, I had a great experience there. But yeah, in hindsight, looking back, it probably would have been smarter for me to go more the high performance junior route. Although, I mean, that path has its own different set of frustrations, but big, you know, obstacles and frustrations of its own, namely parents and just dealing with the pressures there, dealing with the personalities and the egos on the parent side of things, and just dealing with, it's just kind of a pressure cooker environment. I don't know. Maybe I would have thrived there. But frankly, I never had the chance to try it. But I don't plan on stopping what I'm doing to go try it either.
For sure. We hope you don't. But yeah, it's very interesting. You know, as you mentioned, the troubles with parents, and you know, I have a college teammate, Irfan, and he actually has a brother who's on the pro tour playing doubles. But you know, we talked a while ago about him having a tough choice between staying at his country club where he gets paid a lot more, versus going to like a high performance junior place where he'll have, like you said, those set of things to consider with the parents, and also less salary. So that can be a tough choice for sure. Yeah. But yeah, Ian, you know, going to the Essential Tennis Podcast, I mean, like I said, it's like pretty much the longest standing tennis podcast out there to help you improve your game, and you've been doing it for a while. And so, I mean, first off, where can we check that out if we want to listen to some episodes?
Wherever people listen to podcasts, it's under, you know, it was the main thing that I did for years. And yeah, it was, as far as I'm aware, I was the first tennis podcaster on the internet. I need to go and check that, but I'm pretty sure I was the first one out there doing it. And I went 3.5 years without missing a Monday. Mm. I was really, really proud of that streak. And for a while, I was actually doing multiple shows a week. But after a while, video just kind of took over, and my attention really got pulled away from it. And so for a while, it was really on the back burner, or I ignored it completely for long stretches of time. And now I'm finally back to doing every Monday again, which it feels really good to finally have some momentum back into it, and it's just some new content, new listeners, and we're publishing it in a lot of new places now. Forever, it was either you listen to it on our website or you listen to it on iTunes, and that's, or like, you're savvy enough to have your own podcast app or podcast stream manager, and you know, you can get the stream URL. But now we're on Stitcher, we're on Podbean, it's under review for Spotify. It should be live on Spotify very soon. Or of course it's still on iTunes. And so yeah, my goal is to just distribute it everywhere where people possibly find podcasts. So you can just Google it as well, and that'll bring up the feed and also the iTunes link.
Yeah, for sure. And I listen to my podcast on Podcast Addict, so I'm pretty sure it's on there too. And I think Google Play also rolled out something, but I don't know how that's going with podcasts. But good stuff. Yeah, we'll definitely link up, the links to the podcasts on the show notes page, which is at tennisfiles.com/61. And so what can we expect, Ian, moving forward with the podcast? You know, what types of content should we be looking out for?
Yeah, the pod, I'm really enjoying it, actually. I love video, but I think the podcast is just my favorite medium. It's just a really personal delivery, and it's kind of my diary. It's kind of my coaching diary. It's the first time I've thought about it in that sense, but I think that's the best way to describe it. We work with students here in Milwaukee a couple times a month, and they're really focused, really intensive time periods with these players. And my big kind of quest over the last year or two has been developing a coaching methodology that is very, very different from anything else out there. And I say that being completely honest. I'm not aware of any other place in the world where tennis coaches or instructors are using the process anywhere close to what we're using as far as implementing video and multiple coach, where we have four coaches on the court for one student at a time, which sounds ridiculous, but you know, I could explain, like, everybody has their own role to serve the student, and we all have kind of our own little part of the process that we work on. And so it's kind of my laboratory, and the podcast is my place where I kind of decompress and share stories and kind of theses. Is that a word? Theses?
I think so.
Thesis. Yeah. I develop my thesis around coaching on the court, and then the podcast is kind of where I write my thoughts and my notes down and share it. And so in the past, I would take a lot of listener questions, and I still do that. But more frequently than not, everything over the last 6 months has been very much focused on the learning process and how if you're listening to the podcast, you want to get better at tennis. How do you get better at tennis without the luxury of a great coach right there next to you? And I think that's the position a lot of your listeners are in, and a lot of my listeners are in. They either don't have the finances, or they've got the means, but they can't find a coach, sadly, that meets, it's kind of like the position I was in. They can't find a coach that actually meets their level of passion and focus for wanting to get better. Most students out there are at a very, a very entry-level of passion for improvement, or maybe they just don't care at all. That's most tennis players out there. And so as a result, there's a tremendous amount of coaches out there that's their day. Every day is servicing those players, and they've fallen into a rut of just delivering that level of product, that level of service. And so there's a small subset of players out there who are absolutely rabid about getting to the next level, but they can't find a coach that actually is able to give them the service that they need, or the level of insight, the level of process, the level of feedback that they need to actually break through as an amateur athlete, somebody who isn't a world-class, you know, as far as kinesthetic awareness or athleticism or coordination. You know, it takes more than just being like swing low to high to hit topspin. I mean, it just takes more depth of knowledge and depth of communication to a student than that. And so I'm always really careful. Like, I don't want to talk down to coaches, but it's just kind of the reality. And it's the communication I'm getting from players all over the world is, and that's why, frankly, we have an audience. That's why people listen to my show is to get insights into how they can lead themselves through the learning process and successfully make changes to their habits, which is an extremely difficult thing to do without a really fundamentally sound process to follow. So sorry, that's a long answer, but in a nutshell, that's what the podcast is for.
No, and I mean, I really just have to applaud you, you know, for all the great work you guys are doing. And I mean, it's very, I mean, self-evident if you, you know, listen to the podcast or if you check out, you know, the videos, even, you know, you have some incredible videos on your YouTube channel, you know, where you basically are giving us a glimpse into a full lesson where, as you mentioned, you have mm-hmm. several pros on the court and you're, you know, recording video of the person's strokes and then playing it back to them and showing them techniques on how they can, like you said, break their habits and form new ones. And so mm-hmm. it's really, really cool. And, you know, I've definitely learned a lot from it. And I think everybody should for sure check it out. Again, just great work with that. And I also did want to ask you maybe a couple like sort of tip questions. So, you know, in your opinion, sure. you know, what are a couple of tips to help us be more successful at playing singles?
I think singles is compared to doubles, singles is a really simple and straightforward game that I think it really just comes down to a couple really basic patterns of play. And I think the most successful singles players are the players that are A, aware of those patterns, and then B, just execute them just with incredible focus and what's the word I'm looking for? Intention. Like if you're not aware of the patterns and you're not very purposefully, very intentionally deploying those patterns point after point after point, then it's just a crapshoot who wins each point. If both players have low awareness and both players have low intention about what they're doing, where they're aiming and why, then it just comes out to a roll of the dice. Like who's going to win each point and who's going to win the match. The reason why you see players like, I mean, Nadal is my favorite example. Ferrer is a great example. There's a lot of professional players out there who really exude this kind of principle of just know your role, know the patterns, and then no matter what happens, just stick to that pattern and just play the percentages and grind down your opponent. It's not the right like plan A or playing philosophy for every player. Like there's different personalities, there's different strengths and weaknesses. But if you don't have kind of a foundation of knowledge and execution of those base patterns, then building offense or more of an attacking game on top of just kind of crappy discipline and crappy patterns is just going to make success very, very difficult.
Gotcha, and it's awesome stuff. And then, you know, obviously you mentioned that doubles is a little more complex. So any advice on that front, and also, you know, why it's more complex?
Oh, man. Yeah, there's double the players. That's the main thing. And so in any given situation, you've got at the amateur level, at the recreational club level, whatever you want to call it, generally speaking, you've got an offensive player and a defensive player. Towards higher levels of doubles, you've got all four players kind of trying to get to the net. That's a pretty small minority of tennis. Like it's not a lot of people as a percentage that are like serving and volleying and attacking right away. Most tennis players, there's a defensive player and an offensive player. And so for me, I think the first level of awareness and the most important one is doing two things. Number one, being aware of what phase of play you are in with the shot you're about to hit. In other words, is this a defensive shot that I'm in? Am I hitting from below the net? Or am I hitting from far away from the net? Or am I hitting from off the court? Or is it neutral? Is it kind of like 50-50 and nobody really has the upper hand? Or am I attacking? Am I in an offensive position or an offensive phase of play? And then once you've identified if you're neutral, defensive, or offensive, being really, really aware and purposeful about what target you're choosing. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the pattern that drives me the most crazy is players in doubles who have an offensive opportunity and they have a choice between hitting towards the other offensive player or the other defensive player. And in doubles, in tennis in general, but doubles in particular, time is unbelievably valuable. And so if you can purposefully choose to hit towards the person with the least amount of time to react in an offensive situation, that should be your choice like 95% of the time. But if you go watch any random doubles match at any random tennis court, you will see players at the net with high, easy offensive shots hitting back to the person who has three or four times more time to react to that shot, aka the defensive player, aka the player who's back behind the baseline. And that just resets the point, which is ironic because everybody complains about how much they get lobbed. And they get this sitter easy volley and they hit it back to the person who's 40 feet away from them, who of course is going to lob the ball because they're in a defensive situation. And so that's just, you know, one very, like, the most obvious example for me. But I think being aware of phase of play and then purposefully choosing the right target. And so that means if you have a low volley, the worst possible place to hit would be the person close to you because they're in an opportunity to attack. And so that's where you want to target the person further away to act as kind of a pressure release and hopefully reset the point and have a better opportunity on the next shot. So for me, that's doubles in a nutshell, but I could talk about doubles for literally like 10 hours. That's like the first layer. And then from there, it's all about being proactive and doing things ahead of time instead of being reactive, waiting to see what you're receiving and then doing something afterwards, which is, again, what the vast majority of tennis players are doing, is they're playing their doubles from a reactive mindset and execution instead of a proactive mindset and execution.
Yeah, I really love that. It's wonderful advice. And, you know, as you were speaking, I was thinking of a visual where, you know, like you have a sitter, you know, a forehand sitter that you can either crush to like the person who's at the net, who's probably scared crapless, or, you know, back to the baseline. And, you know, you should hit to the person who has way less time in that, you know, and you shouldn't be afraid of like, oh, you know, I don't want to hit him. You know, I mean, if you want to win anyway. So that's my take on that. But so, Ian, just want to ask you as well. I mean, I've noticed, you know, you recently put out a vlog, which is really, really cool. I've been watching them all and really interesting stuff. And so I wanted to ask you, you know, real quick, like why you decided to do a vlog.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. For those of you who are listening that aren't sure what a vlog is, it's right. What the kids these days are calling a video, usually daily, but not always, but just a video that shows kind of day in the life or behind the scenes or general, not always, but generally kind of more candid video content, not as highly produced. Again, not always, but frequently. And so that's what I've been doing is about 6 weeks ago, I hired a camera guy. This sounds insane to anybody who's unaware of this content style, but I hired a camera guy to come into the office every day and follow me around and record what I do and what I say. And every day I publish a video showing what I did the day before. And sounds like the most like egomaniac like thing like possibly do. But I didn't really have like an end game in mind or like a big like master plan or strategy or anything like that. But I believe strongly in giving first. And I believe strongly in building an audience in general, like in life. And I believe strongly in helping people and giving insights where I can and helping people be more successful in their own lives. And so those are kind of the main reasons why I started doing this. And I wanted to experiment with maybe trying to build a different kind of audience. Not necessarily tennis players, but people who are interested in how an internet business works and how do you grow a company online and how do you do social media and how can you be successful on YouTube and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Like this is what we do every day in the office. And so I wanted to experiment with creating a new audience around a different topic with as little personal creation or investment as possible. And so that's basically what this is. And so every morning I wake up and there's a new video waiting to get published from what I did the day before. And so we're working on on trying to make that as interesting and valuable as possible without making it super pre-planned or produced or that sort of thing. And it's a difficult thing. That's a difficult combination to pull off, especially when you're not like a super charismatic, like extroverted, enthusiastic person. Like I'm not any of those things. And so it's been interesting for me to watch myself. And it's been interesting to try to make that kind of content successful. And yeah, we've done 33 episodes of it now, I think. And yeah, it's been an interesting experiment, and we'll see where it goes.
It's great stuff, Ian. Yeah, again, you know, I've been enjoying them a lot, and I know how much hard work this is, because at last year's City Open in DC, I actually had my buddy Victor, one of my best friends. We actually did a vlog for each day of the tournament, and it was just a lot of work. I mean, he was just filming constantly, and then, you know, I had to, you know, I picked out like, I don't know, like 50 different clips or something like that, and then put it together. And it's definitely tough, but it's really cool. I mean, I actually saw a vlog by a professional poker player named Daniel Negreanu for the World Series of Poker.
I subscribed to him, actually. That's funny.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. So I'm really into to poker. But so actually, after I saw that, I was like, man, this is amazing. And that's when I wanted to try it. And it was, like I said, a lot of hard work, but really cool. And I'm really appreciative personally of you, you know, putting all the hard work into that vlog, because I definitely love watching. Ian, I know you don't have too much time left here, but just a couple maybe rapid-fire questions. One for you is, what are three books that you'd gift to a friend to help them become a better tennis player?
The first one is super easy. I've been kind of obsessed, like I said a little bit earlier, I've been kind of obsessed with developing kind of a different philosophy or process on the tennis court. And okay, so there's two books that for me have really influenced that heavily. The first one is The Art of Learning by Josh Waitzkin.
Oh yeah, nice.
That really kind of kicked things off for me maybe 4 or 5 years ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, and really kind of confirmed a lot of kind of thoughts that I had in my head or experiences that I'd had on the court and kind of ways that I've been thinking about the learning process. So that's the first one. And the second, the more recent one, which I can't believe I've never heard of. This is going to be only the second place, as far as I'm aware, Mirabon. The first place is my own podcast and now your podcast. I can't believe that this is not like a staple in tennis. And I think it needs to be. Until I write my book about this, which is going to be more tennis focused. But in the meantime, the book Mastery by George Leonard, for me, it was just completely mind blowing. And kind of the same kind of thing. Josh Waitzkin's book really kind of confirmed a lot of things and really kind of solidified the path that I felt like I was on, and gave me kind of the next couple steps of vision kind of on the path that I was taking. And the same kind of thing, but now, I don't know, maybe a year ago, I got Mastery by George Leonard. And there's like multiple pages of like tennis specific examples in this book. And it's all about mindset and process around mastering a skill. And the fact that I've never heard of this book from any other tennis source, frankly, to me, is just kind of embarrassing. I'll just be super like transparent. I think the content in that book is exactly what's missing in tennis coaching. Not all tennis coaching, but when I say tennis coaching, I mean in a very homogenistic, like holistic, you know, like the state of your average tennis lesson, I think is absolutely missing what's in that book. And it's really what I'm passionate about. And I'm working on a book right now that's just going to kind of be a compilation of lessons or mindsets or insights into tennis. But hopefully, as soon as that book is done, I'm going to start working on a second book, which is going to be all about the learning process and the teaching process around tennis. But it'll be kind of universally applied to getting better at anything, because I think there's principles that apply universally to improvement in any kind of skill or discipline. And I think there's just a massive amount of misinformation and misunderstanding in tennis, and I'm sure in other disciplines as well, about how that actually happens and how to facilitate that as a coach, or how to facilitate that for yourself if you don't have the finances or you don't have the access to a great coach. Neither of those are tennis books. Man, you asked for three. I mean, I don't know, Winning Ugly or something. What everybody says Winning Ugly, so that's number three.
There you go. But yeah, focus on those two books, everybody, and appreciate those suggestions. And Ian, when do we possibly expect your book to come out, do you think?
I've been working really hard on it. It'd be great to have it out later this year. It could possibly not be until 2019. For sure 2019. But later in 2018 would be great. It's going to be a compilation of a lot of different content that I've done over the years, but reformatted and kind of put together into a enjoyable book format instead of like a podcast format or a tip of the day video format. It's going to be like 60 or 70 short chapters grouped into different categories. And yeah, hopefully that'll be out by the end of the year. But if not, then for sure 2019.
Awesome. Really looking forward to that, Ian. And so what do we, have to look forward to with Essential Tennis? Is there any particular projects or anything, obviously besides your book, that's going to be coming up soon?
I think the best place to connect with us is probably YouTube. Like that's just where all of our we take the same content and we kind of repackage it for other platforms, Facebook and Instagram or two other main other ones, but YouTube is really the platform where we're engineering content for that specifically that platform. And so I think if you want like the purest version of what we're doing, then our YouTube channel is probably the top place to really pay close attention to us. If you're into more kind of intellectual process related stuff, then my podcast is probably the best place. If you're looking for actual visual examples of how it looks and how it works in real life, then YouTube is the best place.
Gotcha. And any socials you want to point out for us to check out?
Probably Facebook would then be the next one. We publish tons of stuff on Facebook. Unlike YouTube, we're constantly bringing back lessons that we've published in the past. And we've published an unbelievable amount of content at this point. So we're constantly cycling through stuff and kind of giving light to past content in addition to the new stuff that we're coming out with. So YouTube is like the first place where you'll see our newest stuff, and Facebook is a great kind of compilation of just kind of a feed of everything that we've done over the years, in addition to what's new and coming out.
Awesome stuff. And you all definitely want to subscribe to the YouTube channel for sure. And so, Ian, I like to close the podcast episodes with one final question, which, you've given us a lot of great tips here. But what is one key tip that you can give us right now to help us improve our tennis games?
Go video yourself right now. Yep. I don't care how long you've been playing tennis. I don't care what level you are. I don't care how many YouTube videos you watch. I don't care how many books you read. I don't care how many podcast episodes you listen to. If you've never watched yourself hit a forehand or a serve or a backhand, you have no idea what you're actually doing on the court. No idea. And so no other tip I could give is possibly as important as that. If you've never videoed yourself, take the phone out of your pocket, aim it towards the baseline, and hit record. It's unbelievably easy, it's free, and it's by far the biggest ROI that you can spend your time on the court. Because if you don't know what you're doing, then how in the world can you possibly hope to target the right things that will help you improve the fastest or the most? And so, unfortunately, Most players and most coaches are completely blind out there. And of course, like over the years, you develop kind of your coaching eyes. Telling you right now, and we've got four coaches on a court working with a student, and I can be standing 10 feet away with another different coach feeding, standing there, which hardly anybody does either, with an iPad, and my eyes will see one thing and the video shows something else. Standing there looking for something very specific, and depending on the swing and the technique that we're looking at, I'm not sure until I look at the iPad. And that's a completely different story from being 80 feet away on the other side of the net feeding balls and saying like instructions. A completely different world over on the other side of the court. So if you're a coach and you're not using video, you're doing your students a disservice. If you're leading yourself through tennis improvement and you're not videoing yourself, you're wasting a lot of time. And I say those, like, I don't overstate things. Like, I truly believe those two statements, and hopefully it motivates people to finally do it, because unfortunately most players and most coaches are not doing it, and it blows me away.
Very well said, Ian. I was actually at a fun little event for our captains in our county, and I was actually telling them how much how helpful recording yourself is, and then one player said, "Oh, my mind was blown. One time I videoed myself and I couldn't believe like what I was doing. Like I realized that I, XYZ and all that." So, just a really great closing tip there, Ian. So, Ian, I just want to thank you so much for everything you're doing. You're putting out content on so many different platforms. You're vlogging, YouTube videos, podcasts, putting out courses, and it's just incredible what you and your team are doing. Shout out to James, Ira, Kirby, Kevin, Megan, and also James from your team. But you're all doing fantastic work, and I can't recommend you all highly enough for everybody to check out all your stuff. And we'll have again the links at tennisfiles.com/61. So thanks, Ian, and keep doing what you're doing. And just looking forward to checking out all the great stuff that you and your team are putting out. So appreciate it.
Yeah, man. Appreciate your support. Thanks for the kind words and for the great conversation. I hope listeners out there got something out of it, and looking forward to hearing what people think. Appreciate you having me on.
Oh, anytime, Ian. Thanks so much. All right. I hope you all really enjoyed my interview with Ian Westerman from Essential Tennis. I really did. And he definitely brings a great perspective to the game. As you can tell, he's a very insightful and intelligent individual. And he and his team are doing a fantastic job. So if you want to check out Essential Tennis, you can check out all the show notes, which will have the links that we mentioned on the show today at tennisfiles.com/61. That's tennisfiles.com/61. And I'd also really appreciate it if you could subscribe to the Tennis Files podcast. And you can do that in iTunes or any podcast app that you use to listen to the show by just hitting the subscribe button. And if you're interested in checking out Tennis Summit 2018, you can do that at tennisfilesummit.com. That's tennisfilesummit.com. And I'd like to leave you all with a quote, as I often do at the end of the show. And this one is by the Buddha. And he said, "There are only two mistakes one can make along the road to truth, not going all the way and not starting." Love that quote. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. Thanks for all the support throughout the years. And I'm looking forward to producing a lot more great podcast episodes and pieces of content for you all to improve your tennis games. So thanks again. All the best. And we'll see you on the next episode of the Tennis Files podcast. Take care, everyone.
Thanks for listening to the Tennis Files podcast. For more tips to help you improve your tennis game, visit tennisfiles.com.